All right, so on to a new system for the second half of this unit before we get another test. This is the urinary system, which sometimes is called the renal system. Urinary system is kind of the better word because renal just means of the kidneys, and the kidneys are just a part of the system. On the other hand, the production of urine is just one of the functions of the system. So they're both problematic terms, really. Anyway, we usually nowadays call it the urinary system. And anatomically, there's not a lot of complexity. There's a little bit of complexity inside the kidneys, as we'll see. But as far as the major structures are concerned of the system itself, pretty simple. There's really just six things total, six major structures, and not even that many kinds of structures because there's pairs of them as well. So you have two kidneys, obviously, two ureters, one per kidney, and a ureter is just a tube that conducts urine from the kidneys where that urine is produced to a storage device, which is the urinary bladder. Don't call it just the bladder. It's the urinary bladder as opposed to the gallbladder, for instance. So there's only one urinary bladder. You probably already knew that. And then the final bit is a single urethra. So everything besides the kidneys is really just plumbing and storage. The two ureters continuously conduct urine as it trickles out of the two kidneys to the urinary bladder, which can hold quite a bit, can stretch quite a bit, up to a point, of course, and then the urethra allows for the intermittent voiding of the urinary bladder, at least in people older than babies. Babies don't yet have developed the ability to hold the urine in the bladder. So they can't hold it as long as we can. But in someone, in a normal adult, even though the urine is continuously being produced, it's not continuously being shed from the body. Only when we decide to, up to a point, of course. And so that's what the urethra does. And the kidneys are paired, of course. Right, there's a right and left one, but notice that they don't occur exactly at the same vertical level. One of them is a little higher than the other. Which one is the higher one? The left. Just making sure you didn't say the right, which is on your right. It's right. In this case, a woman, her left is the higher one. That's in most people, of course. What kind of people have the right one be the higher? Not males, no. I mean, roughly half of the people I'm talking about are males. The other half are females. But what would have to be the case for the right one to be the higher one? For the liver to be on the other side, everything would be reversed, in other words. What do we call that? Haven't I talked about this?
Yeah.
Situs inversus. I think it's US on the inversus. I'm not sure, actually. Could be IS. Anyway, that's only one in every, I think, like 10,000 people or something like that, or one in 1,000 at most. Most people have the left kidney a little bit higher, like you see, and Yeah, the liver is the biggest thing right there on the right side, and it displaces it slightly to downward. Although the kidneys are not right in the middle of the depth of the abdomen. They're really embedded in the back wall. So they're kind of out of the way of everything. Well, I'll talk more about that when we get to a better picture to describe that. But anyway, the two kidneys, even though they aren't at the same level vertically, are pretty much identical in size. Each one is roughly the size of your fist. And they're mirror images of each other. They are shaped a lot like a kidney bean. So this is another example of an organ that has a hilum. Remember we talked about the hilum of the spleen and the hilum of what else? Lymph nodes, right. All of those, or in both of those instances, the hilum was a place for connection with tubing, right? Same thing for a kidney. The hilum is the concave indentation on the medial part of the organ, whether it's the right or the left, it's the medial part toward the midline. And that's where you'll see blood vessels connect, and also an artery and a vein, a renal artery and a renal vein for each of the two. And also where there isn't plumbing, where the ureters exit the kidneys. By the way, we get a good look here of the adrenal glands, which is, like I said, why they get their name. They are adrenal. They are on the kidneys. But they are not part of the urinary system. Of course, they're part of the endocrine system. While we're looking at this view, you can get a good idea of just how well perfused the kidneys are. Now, why does this make sense? Why? Right, because urine formation is largely filtration of blood. Urine is just blood with certain things removed. This is why, by the way, if you were given a choice of drinking someone's blood or drinking someone's urine, it would be safer to drink the urine. Because the blood has everything in it the urine has, plus other things that are too big to get through the kidneys, including cells, which could hurt you, bacteria. It's better, of course, not to drink either. But in a person without a post-renal infection, urine should be sterile. No cells should be in it. Anyway, that's the hilum, where all this tubing connects, and just a hell of a lot of blood gets delivered to the kidneys, because their job is to not just filter it. I don't want to give you the idea that urine is just blood that's filtered. It is filtered blood, but some stuff that makes it out of the blood when it's first filtered gets put back into the blood because you don't want to get rid of it. And also some stuff that does not get filtered, but you want to get out of the blood, actually gets pumped into the urine from the blood. So it's more than just filtration. Anyway, to deal with all that blood, you have to send a lot of blood to it, and that's why the renal arteries are huge vessels. And notice they branch directly off the abdominal aorta, which itself, of course, is a huge, it's the biggest artery in the body. The urethra is really the only part of the system that there's a difference for between men and women. And that's because the urinary system and reproductive system develop together and they share some parts, right? Now, in men, the urethra is longer than in women. That's because the urethra runs through the penis. So there's also a lot more variance in the length in men because of the variance in penis length, whereas in females, it's pretty much the same length. The urethra in females is dedicated for urine flow. It's the only thing it's for. But in males, it does double duty. It conducts urine, but it also conducts semen. So, as I was saying, the reproductive and urinary systems come together in males. And in other animals, for instance, a bird, you have one opening for all for not only the reproductive and urinary systems, but for the digestive system as well. So that one opening, the cloaca on a bird, is eggs come out of that, feces and urine, all three. That's probably enough for this first slide. Let's take a closer look at things. Slide two. Before I even talk about slide two, I didn't really go through the major functions of the organ system since we're just starting it. Now, of course, urine production is a major function of the urinary system. But production, why produce urine? I mean, it's really the production of urine accomplishes several different functions. The urinary system has as a chief or primary function excretion. What is excretion? It's the main excretory system. It's not the only one that accomplishes excretion, but what is excretion? It is a type of getting rid, but so is elimination, for instance. Elimination is accomplished by the digestive system. Defecation, the elimination of feces, that is elimination. It's not excretion, because that's something that was never in the body to begin with, as I keep saying, right? As it passes through that tube, that's not in your body, really. Not in the cells of your body. Excretion is removal of waste from cells and therefore from tissues. But what is a waste? Well, it's basically something that either can harm you or that you just have too much of. So there are various kinds of wastes. And like I said, the urinary system is not the only system that does excretion. The digestive system also does some excretion, but the excretion done by the digestive system is actually when it pumps things from cells into the lumen of the digestive tract, which is in addition to the elimination that happens. Also, your integumentary system does a little bit of excretion. Sweat accomplishes excretion because it's not just water, right? Sweat isn't just pure water. In fact, actually, water can be excreted. Even if it were pure water, that would be excretion because you're getting rid of it from cells. But in addition to the water that sweat contains, it also has in it various salts. Inorganic salts get excreted when you sweat. Also, some urea, which is one of the main things that gets excreted by the urinary system. So the urinary system is not the only excretory system, but it is the main excretory system. So that's definitely a function, excretion. But it's more than just that. The urinary system also is important for maintenance of fluid balance. So it adjusts blood volume, and mainly it does that by adjusting how much of the water that gets filtered gets put back into the blood and how much stays in the urine. The more stays in the urine, the less there is left in the blood, and therefore the blood volume goes down. The more it gets saved in the blood, the more the blood volume stays the same. So maintenance of blood volume, and therefore, indirectly, blood pressure, because blood pressure results from whatever the blood volume is. I mean, that's one thing that affects it, right? The more watery the blood is, the higher the blood pressure is. Well, the wateriness of the blood is adjusted by the urinary system. Well, I should be asking you these. What else? Because we've talked about a little bit of this. What else does the urinary system do that we've talked about in other systems in this class? Well, the ureters, the urinary bladder, and the urethra are not involved. Those are only involved in carrying urine out of the body or storing it before it gets carried out. So let me just narrow the question down to saying, what else do the kidneys do that we've talked about already? We haven't really talked about what the kidneys do for excretion, but we've talked about other things they do. What about white blood cells? No, but you're close when you say blood cells. Erythropoietin. Erythropoietin, which is what kind of thing? It's a hormone, and it's released by the kidneys. And what process is under the control of erythropoietin? Erythropoiesis, which is what? Production of red blood cells, right. So the urinary system also controls the blood with respect to how many red blood cells are in that blood, which is totally separate from its, you know, adjusting it by filtering it. Because the erythropoietin has to talk to the bone marrow in order to produce those red blood cells. Okay, what else? And I think I've talked about, well, I definitely have talked about this in 201. I don't remember whether I mentioned it in here yet. There's another thing that the kidneys are involved in producing that's important in the body. What do we call things that you absolutely have to have but you can't produce on your own? Vitamins. What vitamin am I talking about? It is a letter. Vitamin D. What is the? Do you remember how vitamin D is produced? Now, vitamin D is an exception because we can produce our own vitamin Ds, even though we call it a vitamin. But what's the first step in that? What do you have to have in order to make your own vitamin D? Sunlight. When sunlight strikes the skin, it transforms a cholesterol-like compound into what? Anyone remember? Cholecalciferol, which then travels via the blood to where? Not yet. Liver. And that cholecalciferol gets transformed in the liver into what? Calcidiol. Right? Diol meaning two alcohols, two hydroxyls. That's what the liver does. It puts an additional hydroxyl on. It already had one as cholecalciferol. Gets turned into calcidiol, which then leaves the liver and goes to where? The kidneys, and that's why it's involved in the urinary system. And the kidneys add still another hydroxyl to it, forming what? Calcitriol. And calcitriol is the active form of vitamin D. So where does calcitriol then travel and do most of its job? Small intestine, right, which is where it does what? Right, it facilitates the absorption of calcium from the diet. So it's not the source of the calcium. Calcitriol is the vitamin that allows a lot more calcium that's in the food and outside your body to be taken into the body. Without the help of vitamin D, it would stay in the feces and be eliminated from the body and never get into the body. Okay, so the urinary system is important for proper skeletal system maintenance, right? Because that's a major job of the calcium. But not only I mean, that's where the calcium gets stored, and it's what strengthens the bone. But why is calcium also important? It is a major signal molecule. For instance, as we've been talking about in cell bio, this is how your neurons work. This is how they're able to release neurotransmitters, by influx of calcium ions. It's also how your skeletal muscles work. Calcium is the signal that allows your muscles to contract in response to action potentials. And it's a signal for a lot of other things as well. So kidneys really have very far-reaching functions because of all these things that are involved, besides just excretion, which itself is, of course, a vital function. It's just not the only thing it does. And so it's not surprising that we have redundancy. You definitely cannot live without kidneys, right? Well, you have two, even though you can live with just one. It's redundancy, just like in an airplane. It's all the important stuff. You know, like an engine, you have two of, because if one fails, the other one will take up the slack. Okay, so when it comes to the excretion function, one of the major things that the kidneys get rid of, it gets rid of a lot of stuff, including drugs, including hormones that have been in your system already. They don't, you know, it's important for hormones not to last forever, right? Because they are signals. You only want that signal to have an effect when it was appropriate, which is when it was released. If they never got metabolized or eliminated, excreted, then they would continue to have their effect forever. But among those various things, the one major thing that gets excreted is nitrogenous waste, meaning, of course, that it includes nitrogen. Now, of the four biological macromolecules, which two of them have nitrogen in them? Proteins or polypeptides, and what else? Nucleic acids, right. Those both have nitrogen in them. Every amino acid has nitrogen in it, therefore every polypeptide, which is a polymer of amino acids, has nitrogen in it. Every nucleotide, which is the monomer of nucleic acids, has nitrogen in it, right? Because every nucleotide has a nitrogenous base on it, either adenine, guanine, cytosine, uracil, or thymine, depending on what the nucleic acid is. Therefore, when these things get metabolized, proteins or nucleic acid, when they get catabolized, specifically broken down, you produce a waste that has nitrogen in it. That's, by definition, nitrogenous waste. Well, when proteins get degraded, the main nitrogenous waste is ammonia. It produces ammonia. And ammonia is highly toxic to the cells. So it's not something you want to build up a very high concentration of. The cells will not tolerate that. And so that's a major function of the kidneys, to get rid of ammonia. Now, uric acid, before I get to uric acid, ammonia by itself, highly toxic, like I said. So one of the many jobs of the liver is to convert that ammonia into something that is still toxic, but just less so, and therefore it kind of immediately takes care of part of the job. It converts ammonia into urea. And urea is a chief component of urine. So urea is still something you can't let build up forever, but you can have a higher concentration of urea without damaging yourself than you can of ammonia. All right, so that's these first two on top come from mainly the breakdown of proteins. Now, by the way, if urea level gets too high, what do we call that condition? Anyone know? if urea gets, the concentration gets too high, it starts to precipitate out of solution. It crystallizes, and this happens mostly in the joints, which causes a lot of pain. The pain is bad, of course, but it's mainly bad because of the other stuff it does besides the pain. That's called gout. Gout is painful because of this precipitation of urea crystals. And so what would a typical physician tell you if you had gout? What would the recommendation be? Other than to take whatever the drug is that's... Well, they might say drink more water, but what about the diet? Well, you're all young enough not to worry about gout, so you probably don't know us, but if anyone who has gout, the doctor will say, cut down on the amount of meat you eat, yes, because it's so much protein in meat. So anyway, ammonia and urea, mainly from, they're nitrogenous wastes from the breakdown of proteins. Uric acid is a nitrogenous waste produced by the breakdown of nucleic acids. And so that has to be dealt with as well. And then finally, creatinine, you should be careful with this word. The nitrogenous waste is called creatinine. Okay? But that comes from breakdown of creatine, which is almost exactly the same word. Just notice the additional IN in creatinine. Okay? What is creatine? Or creatine? Anyone know? It functions as a phosphagen. But what is a phosphagen? Well, phosphate is definitely involved, yes. A phosphagen, gen meaning create or generate, a phosphagen is a phosphate, a temporary phosphate storing molecule. And I say temporary because its job is to hand off that phosphate to something that is the usual carrier of phosphates as far as energy is concerned. What am I talking about? What important energy-carrying molecule has phosphates on it? ATP, right. ATP is the most versatile of your energy-carrying molecules. It's used for all sorts of things that require energy. Well, you don't store much ATP because ATP is continuously being used, so it's continuously going back and forth between ATP and ADP. How do you produce ATP usually? What? Yeah, you always phosphorylate ADP to make ATP, but what is the usual mechanism that you use to do that? What biochemical pathways produce ATP? You cell bios know this. It's glycolysis first, and then what? What follows glycolysis? Cellular respiration, right. Glycolysis and cellular respiration are major ways in which you make ATP, right? Using the energy that originally was in your food. You're breaking down fuels to do that. Well, phosphagens are stored mainly in your skeletal muscles, which are require a hell of a lot of ATP. These phosphagens are molecules that have a phosphate on them, but they can quickly hand it off to ADP, which you can think of as a spent ATP, to turn it right back into ATP without actually burning a fuel. Okay? So phosphagens go back and forth between being phosphorylated and dephosphorylated themselves. It's a way of storing the phosphate in a form other than ATP so that it can then be handed off to ADP to make fresh ATP again. Well, anyway, creatine is your major phosphagen, and that's most of it is in your skeletal muscles, like I said. When that gets broken down, though, that produces creatinine, which is a nitrogenous waste. So that's also dealt with by the urinary system. Okay, let's go to three. What sort of view are we looking at here? What kind of section is this? This is a transverse section at the level of the stomach and pancreas, as we see. So the top of this, as you see, is the front, the anterior aspect. And what I was starting to mention earlier, but I said I would wait until I have a better picture, is that the kidneys are embedded in the rear wall of the abdomen. They are examples of organs that we call retroperitoneal. Now, what does retro mean? Back, in this case, behind. And peritoneal means of the peritoneum. But what is the peritoneum? From 201. What's an example of? What, the peritoneum is an example of what sort of thing? Other examples are the two pleurae, serous membrane, right. The peritoneum is the abdominal serous membrane. And some of the abdominal viscera are enclosed by that peritoneum, like parts of the intestines, part of the stomach. Some are not. Some instead are behind it, actually. And that includes the two kidneys. That's why we call them retroperitoneal. Well, the bluish line here is the visceral peritoneum. It's the visceral layer. Remember, every serous membrane has a visceral layer and a parietal layer. I'm sorry, it's not the visceral, it's the parietal layer, which is the more superficial layer, right? The other layer surrounds the various organs, so it would be all this white stuff combined, all this white layer. That would be the visceral peritoneum around those organs that are peritoneal organs. Not the kidneys, though. The kidneys are fully behind the entire peritoneum, and therefore they are retroperitoneal. Now, the kidneys can move around a little bit, but it's important for them not to move around too much. And what holds them in place are three layers of tissue. The most superficial of those, which is this greenish color, if you can tell the colors from where you are, that's called the renal fascia. And that's connective tissue, fibrous connective tissue, forming an envelope all the way around to the hilum. Immediately deep to that is a pretty thick layer of adipose tissue, which of course is made up of cells that are full of fat, right? So we see that being called the pararenal fat capsule. Pararenal literally meaning around the kidney. So the pararenal fat capsule not only kind of helps it be held in place as well, but its main job, what is the better job, the more important job of the pararenal fat capsule? Yeah, just to cushion it. Not only cushion it, though, what else does fat do? Thermally insulates it, right. So you have a pararenal fat capsule in between the other two layers. The outer layer, like I said, is the renal fascia. And then the inner layer, which is right on the actual surface of the kidney. So it would be this kind of darker red right here, right on the surface of the kidney. That's called the fibrous capsule, which is itself fibrous connective tissue. The rest of the stuff we either have talked about or we'll talk about again with other pictures. So let's go on to four. Now we're finally looking at the kidney in isolation. Real one on the left and a cartoon on the right. It's easier to look at the cartoon to talk about these parts. The kidney is another example, like other ones we've talked about, of an organ that has layers to it. So what's the dichotomy of layers? What are the two layers of called in such an organ? Medulla and cortex, right? Just like the brain has a medulla and a cortex, other ones we've talked about as well. So, and whenever we use those terms, the medulla is always the deeper of the two. The cortex is superficial. Well, except for this major tubing that's occurring at the hilum, if you ignore that, the kidney is pretty much C-shaped. And so the outer part of that C is the renal cortex. And the inner part of that C is the renal medulla. Okay, for the entire length of that C, we use the term medulla and cortex. But the renal core, but along this whole length of the C, we also have subdivisions radially. If you consider the hilum to be like the center of a circle, radii that go through that center subdivide the kidney into what are called lobes. The lobes, each lobe features some renal cortex and one renal pyramid. Each of these triangular things is called a renal pyramid. But you only see the pyramids in the medulla part. Okay? What I'm calling a lobe, though, is one renal pyramid and then the cortex that's associated with it, which is not actually part of the pyramid. So, in other words, this is one lobe of the kidney. Now, the number of pyramids is not a constant. From human to human, it varies a little bit, but 6 to 10 in most kidneys. Each pyramid, what makes it a pyramid, of course, is that it's triangular shape. Well, the tip of that pyramid is called the renal papilla. See that right here. So each of these little tips is a renal papilla. And notice that each renal papilla, which means finger-like or nipple-like projection, each renal papilla is associated with a funnel-like tube called a calyx, C-A-L-Y-X. The plural, what is the plural of calyx? Calyces. C-A-L-I-C-E-S. So there are several calyces, but there are two categories of calyces. There are minor calyces and there are major calyces. Calyx, by the way, means cup. It's a hollow, funnel-like tube that receives the urine from the renal pyramids. Well, the minor calyces are the calyces that receive that urine directly from the pyramids. So each renal papilla is associated immediately with a minor calyx. The minor calyces then converge with each other, or at least certain numbers of them do, to form major calyces. So depending on the kidney, depending on the person, there might be two or three major calyces, which themselves then converge into an even bigger funnel, which is the start. Well, it's called the renal pelvis. Right here is the renal pelvis. Pelvis means basin or sink. The renal pelvis is itself funnel-shaped, but there is one renal pelvis that's receiving the urine from all the various calyces. All the major calyces empty directly into the renal pelvis, but all the minor calyces empty into the major calyces. So the renal pelvis gets all of it. Well, right after it leaves the kidney proper, after it extends through the hilum, then it becomes the very first part of the ureter. So the renal pelvis is much wider than the ureter is, as you see here, but it's continuous with it. It just transitions into the ureter. What else do I want to talk about while I'm here? Actually, I don't think anything. Let's go on to five and talk about blood vessels and the route of blood through them. Keep in mind that it's the blood that is the source of the urine. So, this goes obviously through arteries and veins and capillaries as usual, but there are several different divisions here. Now, aorta is, of course, the main artery, and specifically, as I said, the part of the aorta we're talking about is the abdominal aorta, which is part of the descending aorta, right? The aorta branches, and this is true for each of the two kidneys, but we're just paying attention to one kidney here. The aorta branches into a renal artery first. That's the biggest division of the aorta, which then divides. Well, the renal artery brings blood in through the hilum, of course. So now you're officially in the kidney by the time the renal artery itself divides. When it does divide, it divides into segmental arteries. And because they're called that because each one delivers blood to a different segment of the kidney. So these are the segmental arteries that you see here. Those then divide into interlobar arteries, literally meaning between the lobes I was talking about. Remember that the lobes are defined by the pyramids. Well, look at these red interlobar arteries. They occur right between the pyramids and therefore right between the lobes. So that name makes sense. They then branch into smaller ones called arcuate arteries because they form an arc around the superficial base of the pyramid, not the point, which is the papilla, the other side. The side of the pyramid that actually is right up against the cortex. That's where the arcuate artery makes its arc, for which it's named. Then we're starting to get into ones we don't see much detail on in this, but we'll look at these again in the next slide. Arcuate arteries then branch into cortical radiate arteries. Now, cortical because they're part of the cortex at this point, and radiate because they run along radii that I was talking about, sharing a common center, you know, like radii of a circle. Those cortical radiate arteries divide into afferent arterioles, which are the smallest of the arteries in the kidney. Now, afferent means what? Coming toward, right. So, as we'll talk much more about, the functional unit of a kidney, as far as where the blood actually gets filtered, is, well, part of the functional unit. I shouldn't say it's the functional unit, but part of the functional unit of a kidney is called a glomerulus. And a glomerulus was a word that means little glob, little ball. Well, the glomerulus is a capillary, really. Blood vessel-wise, it consists of a capillary in what's not actually a tangle, but it would look like a tangle. And then that's surrounded by a tube that actually collects the stuff that seeps out of that blood vessel. Okay? Well, the glomerulus, the blood vessel that makes up the glomerulus, is a capillary. The blood that's being brought into that capillary, that glomerulus, is the afferent arteriole because it's bringing it in. All right? So the glomerulus itself features a capillary bed. What am I getting at that I've mentioned before? What's special about the circulation of the kidney? What is it? It has a portal system, right. What is a portal system? Two capillary beds, one after another, with veins in between, without the heart in between, right? Before you get back to the heart. So what are the three portal systems in the body? Hepatic portal system, hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system, and the renal portal system. Okay, so the glomerulus, which isn't shown here, but you'll see a good picture of it, next slide, that's the first capillary bed of the portal system. When the blood, well, the blood that doesn't get actually filtered, the stuff that's still left in the bloodstream after some stuff gets squeezed out in the glomerulus, that then leaves the glomerulus through efferent arterioles. So there's an efferent arteriole for each glomerulus. All right. Now, it's called an arteriole, even though really it should be called a venule. Right? Because a portal system, after the capillaries, we shouldn't be calling them arterioles anymore, after that first capillary bed. But it was called that for whatever reason, and that's still the official name. Now, depending on the glomerulus, or specifically depending on the nephron, which is that glomerulus is part of. A little bit ago when I caught myself and didn't want to tell you that the glomerulus was the functional unit of the kidney, it's the nephron that is the functional unit of the kidney. But each nephron includes a glomerulus. Anyway, there are two classes of nephrons that I'll mention later. Depending on which kind of nephron you're talking about, the efferent arteriole will then lead to either a paratubular capillary or another type of capillary called vasorecta. In either case, though, this is the second capillary bed in series, right? We've already had one at the glomerulus. Now we have another capillary, so that's what makes it a portal system. Now, the rest of the way back, it's almost exactly the same as what came in as arteries, but only veins, with one exception. So whether it's paratubular capillaries or vasorecta, depending on the nephron, those then converge into cortical radiate veins that run right alongside the cortical radiate arteries. Those then collect into arcuate veins that make that arc around the pyramids, and then into interlobar veins. But then instead of having a segmental vein like you would if it were a perfect reversal of the arteries, you skip right to renal vein. And then officially out of the kidney at that point. And where does the renal vein empty into? The inferior vena cava for its trip back to the heart. All right, so everyone understand why it's a portal system? All right. Looks like I probably don't have enough time to make a meaningful start at slide 6, so we might as well adjourn.